Hello and welcome back to the Better Places podcast. On this episode, we're featuring Mete Coban, London's Deputy Mayor for Environment and Energy. Welcome, Mete.
How's it going?
Over the last year, Mete has become a leading voice in shaping how London responds to the climate emergency, not just through policy, but through delivery, cleaning up our air, retrofitting our homes and making our rivers more swimmable. And embedding climate justice into the city's future. From growing up in Hackney to becoming a councillor at just the age of 21, Mete's journey is grounded in his lived experience, deep understanding and a clear sense of who must benefit from the transition to a greener city. His role now touches nearly every corner of London life, from the air we breathe to the energy that powers our homes, to the places and the neighbourhoods being shaped for the next generation. In this episode, we're going to explore what it really means to deliver not just a just transition in practice, but how climate ambition translates into cleaner streets, lower bills, better spaces and good jobs, and how we hold on to public trust and local power as the pace of change accelerates. You've got a big job on your hands, Missy.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me.
No, absolutely.
Long overdue.
Long overdue. And Mete and I have known each other for a very, very long time. And indeed, he's, no disrespect to any of your deputy mayors and indeed the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, but you're high-flying and your diary is something that many should watch because you're often darting from one part of London to the next. So marking your year as deputy mayor, could you just tell us a bit more about you, what your background kind of entails and what surprised you most about your first year in the job?
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm not, as I always say, I'm not a traditional environmentalist and I don't make that a secret. But partly the reason why I care about this issue is because growing up in Hackney and where I grew up on my estate, actually, it was, you know, going home and seeing your parents opening up their energy bills year on year and seeing an increase in their energy prices because we're dependent on fossil fuels. And every time something happens around the world, it's working class Londoners who have to pay the price for it. Or, you know, like even Sidhu, like, you know, when you're out in the estate playing with your friends, I remember at a very young age just, you know, coughing and, you know, mum taking me to the GP and then being given an asthma inhaler pump. And being really worried, what is this thing, mum, that they're giving me? And actually, the point I'm trying to make is the communities who've done the least to cause both the air quality and climate crisis that we live in are those who are impacted most. So for me, this is very much an issue of social justice, racial justice, and economic justice. But it's also a huge opportunity for us to think about how we can redistribute wealth through using the green transition to really uplift every Londoner. You know, I coming into this story, it's a huge privilege to be able to serve. You know, sometimes I have to pinch myself to think, wow, you know, like someone like me from my background represents the city as a deputy mayor. And, you know, the bit that I love about my job, honestly, and this is the best reflection that I've had over the last year, is just meeting so many incredible Londoners and organisations who every day make a difference to make a big difference for the community and the neighbourhoods that they live in. Ultimately, this is about, like you said in your intro, which is around London being not just a place to live to work, but actually a thriving place where people enjoy living. And that's what we're here to help Londoners achieve.
You know, there's so much to unpack there. Not only did you step into public life quite early, and I'd like to touch a bit on some of the work that helped make a name for yourself and also the borough that you represented, leading on things like climate and transport and clean air and Hackney. That's actually one of the, might be one of the best articulations for why your role is so important. Could you tell me a bit more about your experience in Hackney as a cabinet member there and what stuck with you from that experience as you now moved into your city-wide role?
Yeah, look, Hackney is a special place for so many reasons. It's got over 100 languages spoken at the borough. You know, one of the most diverse communities, biggest Turkish-Kurdish community, huge Black African-Caribbean community, biggest Orthodox Jewish community outside of New York in the Western world. you know, biggest Vietnamese community in London.
Because you represented Stoke Newington.
Stoke Newington, yeah.
Which, for anyone who's cutting through parts of London, whether you're on a bus or
the
A10. Or even the A10, if you are so unlucky to drive. It's such a prominent part of London.
It is.
It's one of the most recognisable.
It's got amazing food.
Well, indeed.
Yeah, because you got all
the best kebab.
Best kebab, the famous best kebab.
And then there's that that bagel spot, which
the 24-hour bagel shop.
Probably been there a bit too late sometimes.
You know, you're starting to.
I do indeed. Partly through you, but also it's kind of the heart. Well, Enfield is a beating heart of North London, but
I'll let you have that as a host.
It's one of those places in London that so many people recognise. But again, just on your role, what changes came about in Hackney, but also in the area that you represented that really speak to your fight for social justice, but also that kind of just transition?
Yeah, look, I think one of the powers of being in local government is that you're actually doing leading on change that is like the bread and butter of like community politics, actually doing things that have an impact the next day. So, you know, everything we were doing around the School Streets initiative, for example, you know, making air much quality much more better outside of school. So we saw when we introduced the School Streets, 52 School Streets.
And for our listeners.
And a School Street is essentially
a school street?
Opening and closing time of schools would close the streets outside of the school. So only emergency vehicles and those living in the area would be able to go there.
This might be an obvious question, but why?
Because some of our school playgrounds are really badly polluted. And so since we brought in those school streets, we saw that tailpipe emissions outside our school gates went down by 74%.
Wow.
That means that so many kids across our city who are brought up with stunted lungs, never going to be able to breathe the full capacity of their lungs because of a crisis that they didn't cause in the first place, are now able to breathe much, much more better air quality, more kids cycling to school, more kids walking to school. The stuff we were doing around greening, putting more street trees, we had heat waves this year. We're going to need more street trees because we need more cooler temperatures across our streets. The work that we were doing in Hackney when it came to, you know, getting more clean energy and community energy across our buildings. I worked on this really interesting project, which was called the Residential Solar Project. It was a pilot we were working on with Ofgem and with Desnes. And basically, we went to council estates where we installed 1 megawatt of energy solar power. So 4,000 solar panels. We've had solar panels on council estates before. The difference with this one was that residents could tap into the energy generated on the roof of the estate. Knocks off about 10-15% of their energy bills at a time where people's pockets are pinched. It's so important that we're able to support some of London's most vulnerable residents. So, you know, I think the best bit about local government, and the bit that I miss, if I'm quite frank, actually, although you get to do that at City Hall too, is you're so close to people's day-to-day and you can actually make a big difference to their livelihoods. And yeah, I think local government is, you know, I'm very proud of my time as a servant in Hackney.
And indeed, and your brief touches nearly every aspect of life in London and for Londoners. And again, these kind of real practical measures, I think, helps to justify the argument towards a green transition, but puts in kind of practical scope for many families what it really means for you doing your job, especially with those siren voices that will claim otherwise. I think it's right to say that you've called this London's kind of decade of delivery when it comes to clean energy, homes, water, neighbourhoods. What does delivery look like in practice at a more citywide level?
So for me, delivery at a citywide level, what that looks like is essentially being able to facilitate, you know, actually practically getting things done and what Londoners expect to see from those and us in power. I'm working on a big project at the moment, for example, because we know that we're starting to deal with the impacts of climate change, particularly around like flooding. So we've got much more sustainable urban drainage systems that we're rolling out across the city.
The infamous SUDs.
SUDs, right? Yeah. And SUDs essentially are really important because what it does, it's like a natural reservoir underneath the surface, which slows down the filtration. It slows down the speed of the water that goes into our water streams, but it also cleans the water that goes into our water streams. So actually that's part of our Clean and Healthy Waterways plan, which I'll talk a bit about and what we're going to do around our rivers too. But that's like a very practical thing that we're doing to deliver the work we're doing on retrofit. You spoke about in your intro, you know, we've just announced 22,000 homes that will have improved energy efficiency. So, you know, for me, it's about, you know, what can we practically do in this within this mayoral term that we're just focused on relentlessly on delivery, the work we're doing around creating more access to green space. There's so much that we're currently working on City Hall, and actually in my last 12 months has just been constant announcement of new things that we're delivering, the greener school stuff, getting solar panels across 48 schools in London, saving £15,000 on their energy bills per year, which they can otherwise use for, you know, like activities for children, towards TAs, whatever it may be, down to the school. But it's just getting stuff done, which is what Londoners want to see.
Well, indeed, and the London Growth Plan speaks a lot about kind of fair and greener economy, and you've touched on many aspects of that, from the environment and how SUDs are making our areas more livable. But I'm really quite intrigued, not least because I'm trying to get back into swimming myself, into making our rivers more swimmable.
I can't swim. someone's going to have to jump in when rivers are ready.
I did check, and Nuffield has a membership. It's like a tenner for a pack of 10 or something per session if you ever were interested.
I'm very beginner. I can't even float.
Really?
No.
Did you not go to like, was it like in year 10 and, not year 10, sorry.
Year 5.
Year 5 and 6.
Nah, in my time in Hackney, in schools didn't have. Yeah, they didn't have it. And I had a very bad experience because my brother took me to Britannia Leisure Centre when I was at 4, put me down the slides, coming down into a 6-foot drop.
Oh, God.
I was really enjoying it until I went in the water and it didn't come back up, and then they had to take me out. So I'm still dealing with the fear of that.
We need to work on that by the time you guys clean up the rivers. The River Thames, which is an ambitious plan, isn't it?
Well, one thing I would say before we talk about cleaning up our rivers, it's not a coincidence that there's a lot of black and brown people across London who can't swim, particularly those from more deprived communities. It's an issue of racial justice. Partly it's because of a lack of access to affordable swimming spaces or actually like places to go to swim. And so that was kind of one of the driving factors of us wanting to clean London's rivers. There's 41 rivers in London.
41?
41. Wow. Every single one of our 40 rivers are badly polluted. Not even one of our rivers have a good ecological status, which is an absolute scandal. And it's a scandal that we've just kept kicking the can down the road on it.
Why do you think that is? Why has there not been the will there? And mind you, I have to say, it wasn't where I thought the conversation would go, but it's quite intriguing now that you've opened this up. I certainly agree with you that there are lack of opportunities, and I joke about Nuffield's membership giving you that opportunity, but that's something that I've been considering to refresh my skills.
Yeah.
And the cost of it, even as an adult, is profound. It's like, in some places, it's £350 for sessions of 10. How is the mayor's office, or what's your long-term ambition for clean up our rivers, and how do you think that can help young people's health and other opportunities, life opportunities?
Yeah, look, I mean, partly the reason why I think it's been difficult to get any movement on this is because the responsibility to clean our rivers is very complex.
Yeah.
Because you've got the role of the land authorities, which in many cases the local authorities or sort of private owners. Then you've got the agencies like the Environment Agency and others. The Mayor of London doesn't really have a statutory power when it comes to it. There's issues around funding. Then there's the failings of Thames Water, who've been illegally polluting our rivers for decades and been getting away with it and charging Londoners for their failings of not maintaining. Exactly. And so it's a very complex issue to solve. But, you know, as we've shown with air quality, you know, the mayor is very ambitious about taking on some of the big issues we have. And he wants to clean our water quality in this time. And obviously government's working very hard on it as well. So there's a number of things that we've got planned. So we announced basically that we will create a plan to clean our rivers in the next 10 years. But it's not just going to be a plan that is just on the shelf. In this mayoral term, there's a number of things that we're going to be working on. So one of it is around identifying sites that we're going to be targeting to clean our rivers. So we're going to be identifying up to 10 sites by the end of this year. The other thing that we're going to be doing is looking at, for example, the interlink between the green and blue spaces. I think after the pandemic, people really grew to appreciate like their outdoor spaces.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? And it's important for people's mental health. You know, I know from growing up on an estate on an overcrowded flat, for example, where we didn't have access to a garden. Having access to a garden is a luxury for a lot of Londoners. And, you know, the ability for families to go out and unwind, for people to, for their own mental well-being. So we want to create nice footpaths alongside our waterways. And actually, you've got a really good one in Enfield near Capel Manor opened, which is incredible. So we want to do more work like that. We want to look at nature-based solutions. So we brought back beavers to London after 400 years. Again, you've got it in Enfield. We've got it in Ealing too.
For those who don't know, Enfield is one of the greenest boroughs in the capitals, yeah. Fifth largest of all the boroughs. And we are, well, not only does the leader, Gnobel, who's here on this, in this seat, call it the green lungs of Enfield, we are... We've got the Lee Valley Corridor as well, which is quite a great walkway. And there's a river there that it may not look as polluted as others, but I'm sure it's probably going to be part of the list to try and clean
You're
up.
Doing loads of good stuff on green skills as well. I went to visit one of your colleges and they're doing lots of work with young people, particularly around getting the new generation trained up. So, yeah, no, Enfield is one of the exemplar boroughs when it comes to climate action.
Thank you for that.
And you didn't pay me to say that.
No, not at all. But we are both from North London, so there's that relationship there. But just those plans sound incredible and also really ambitious. I think for us at Better Places, but also at Consilio, we're always trying to find different ways to marry both the private sector and public bodies together. What do you think's key to bringing so many of those different authorities, whether it's the any of the different trusts or those who own these plots of land and local authorities, to try and find someone who's willing to back it financially, one, but also to be that driving force to clean up some of our rivers?
So we've been very successful so far. What we've done is, just to give you a bit and your listeners an update as well, is me and the mayor held a roundtable in March this year where we had essentially all of the key different partners that we needed around the table. So that included London councils, it included the Environment Agency, Thames 21, the work that they do, particularly Thames Water, so many different organisations, you know, the Black Swimmers Association, so many important community organisations too. And we were able to raise 1.8 billion on the back of that roundtable.
Oh, goodness.
And part of that is also getting organisations like TfL, for example, to think about, you know, every time TfL is engaged in a scheme, whether it's a regen scheme with a local authority or whatever it may be, there's an opportunity for us to think about the rollout of SUDs. Mm. Now, the SUDs are important for flood resilience, but it's also fundamentally very important to the work we're doing around the cleaning our rivers. Because if you take Paris, for example, right? Paris cleaned the River Seine, which is obviously incredible work. But when you have rain, the road runoff and the pollution of the road goes straight back into the rivers and the water streams, and it pollutes the rivers, especially if the infrastructure is not there. And so that's why the SUDs are really important to what we're doing. So we're trying to utilize TfL, for example, as a way. So whenever they do a scheme, we're looking at being able to maximise the outcome of the work they're doing. So if they're doing roadworks, can we put some SUDs there whilst they're doing the roadworks? So we're not having to, for example, like put up another cost behind that. So it's about working smarter. Thames Water's putting quite a lot of money into it, and rightly they should, because you know they're a big part of the reason why we're here in the first place. And we've got others who are also contributing, including we're putting 7 million behind from City Hall too, for the work we're going to do. So I think we're now getting to a point where hopefully by the end of the year we'll have a plan that's ready to be presented to the public, and we'll have those sites where we can look at those tangible solutions. But the key thing that I want is that it can't just be like, as I say, like a theoretical document. It needs to be tangible. And I think that's the thing with the green transition, is that what I'm trying to do as Deputy Mayor is really trying to make sure that the benefits of the green transition are tangible to Londoners. People see how it's actually making a difference for their day-to-day lives and what it looks like for their city. And so for me, I'm very clear with the Clean Rivers work, is it's got to be action, and that's what Londoners can expect to see.
No, that's incredible work, and that prospectus of delivery that you put together there, I can't wait to see the kind of fruits of its...
And then we're going to go for a swim.
Well, indeed. No, I'm up for it, bro.
Just to say though, not every river will be swimmable. We want to make some of our, we've got 8 swimmable sites at the moment in London, and when we launched this pledge, we launched a map, because at the moment we didn't have a map to tell Londoners what rivers or reservoirs you can go to. So we've got the West Fres, for example, in Woodbury Down, which is incredible, and some other sites too. And we want to look at some other sites where we can have like swimmable rivers, but of course, like, the, you know, River Thames will never be symbol because it's very tidal. So we would never encourage people to take up swimming there, for example.
Yeah, it's quite rough, the Thames. Two questions off the back of that, which are all incredible work, but more around people and places and not just emissions. How do you see your role feeding into the places that we live in and what they look like and how they're shaped and how that can be, how that can encourage the green transition?
As I say, I think the green transition is one of the biggest economic opportunities of the 21st century. I think it's a huge opportunity for us to think about how do we redistribute wealth? And what I mean, not just financially, but also how do we make sure that for a lot of Londoners who didn't cause the climate crisis in the first place, they don't have the, you know, the luxury to say, hey, I don't like where I live because it's badly polluted or it's got a lack of access to green space. Therefore, I'm going to go off and rent somewhere else or buy it elsewhere. People don't have that sort of money. And so for us, this is about social justice and it's about delivering for Londoners, particularly some of our most vulnerable residents. So for me, it's all about placemaking. It's all about how do we create a sense of co-ownership over our mission to tackle the climate crisis and to deliver fairer, greener London. And that includes basically, you know, creating more access to green space, but actually it's about equity because London is a very green city. Right? 51% of London spatially is green and blue spaces. It's a very green city when you compare it to other cities comparable of its size, like, for example, like in New York or like in LA or whatever it may be. Yeah. But the question is for who? Right?
Oh, yeah.
Question is for who? Is that
it's a tale of two cities for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's, the question is about how do we make sure like that London actually is we're getting equity in the places we need to. So if you're thinking about some very densely populated areas, you know, creating more pocket parks, more street trees, you know, to create that resilience and obviously around heat and flooding, people where people can actually just enjoy the neighborhoods. We want to essentially like, we want to do that. And so for me, you know, one of the key things that we've done actually is about how do we work with Londoners? Because we need to work with them to really realize their ambitions. So we had a youth summit, for example, which was looking at nature. And it was incredible because, you know, had hundreds of young people essentially in a room who were just, you know, coming up with loads of ideas, created that space for them. For how do we make sure we create more livable neighborhoods? But I think what's really important, and I think this is where my background of being a councillor is very helpful, is we can only do this by working with boroughs. It's got to be in partnership with boroughs because boroughs are doing some incredible work. I mean, it's, you know, take Lambeth, the work they're doing around the curbside strategy.
I was just about to mention Lambeth and the curbside strategy. The new parklets and the houses.
Exactly.
And they're repurposing, what was it, 25% of the curbside?
Parkings, yeah, exactly. And they're doing some incredible work. And so what we need to do is actually, and also like, to be quite frank, you know, they are closer to their communities than we are. And so we need to work in partnership with them to make sure that we're actually complementing what they're doing. A good example is, we've done some work with Kew Gardens and Kew Gardens has done a lot of research around the types of species of trees that we need to implement around adaptation of like heat. So if you just plant any tree, it could be that actually those trees could get damaged and actually, you know, like it's damaged rather than, you know, serving its purpose because of the heat. And so what we're doing is because some of the councils may not have that the capacity or the staff capacity, we're working with Kew Gardens to get our research out to the councils so they know how and what types of species they need to be planting. So it's giving them that additional capacity support in terms of what they need to be doing. So it's things like that that we could be doing from City Hall that can help basically actually bolster the efforts of councils that can ultimately deliver for Londoners.
Yeah, that holistic approach I think is all about the intention of City Hall, which is trying to do what you can to create more resilient, livable neighbourhoods in a more holistic way. You've touched on a couple things there, not least around trying to foster not just greener spaces, but more inclusive growth. I wonder, you touched on green skills there, which I know Enfield is championing in. Lambeth even has places like Sustainable Ventures, which champion a lot of climate action and climate work. My question's twofold. Again, what work is being undertaken with some of those new emerging green industries and clean technology to foster inclusive growth? But also, what work are you doing with the states and those corridors that are historically overlooked to make sure that they're coming along with you on this journey?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we had London Climate Action Week this year. It was the biggest ever London Climate Action Week. Over 700 events, 45,000 people across our city. And a big part of the theme around that was, how do we actually, one, accelerate our green economy? We know we need £75 billion of investment in our green economy by 2030 to reach net zero. But actually, more crucially, was about those emerging sectors and how do we help support them in that transition? And what we can do from a City Hall perspective. The London Growth Plan, obviously, is a very important component of how we do that, because within it, it's got, you know, net zero is a key component part of it. And actually, I don't think it's growth-free green. Actually, you can get growth through green. And so what we're trying to do is actually help make sure that London is prepared for those investments that we're going to have across our city. And actually, I think, you know, how we win people's hearts and minds is by making sure... I remember when I was growing up in Hackney and the tech and creative industry started to come to Shoreditch. Before that, Shoreditch wasn't what Shoreditch is now. And it's really weird because, like, I remember when I was growing up, like, there was this excitement that we had on my estate, but no one knew what it meant. But we just sort of felt like there was going to be loads of new jobs created in Hackney. And people were really excited about the sort of the... almost like welcoming the tech and creative industries into London, to Hackney, to our borough. And I think we need to do the same thing with the green transition, which is, how do we actually make sure that the opportunities that are being created for people in our city is actually going to those who need it, or those who've done the least, or who've benefited least from the previous system that we lived in. Otherwise, all that happens is almost like the commodities change, but it's the same people benefit from the same system. And I think that's where people lose trust and faith in politics. And so for me, it's about making sure that actually the... And that's why the work we're doing on retrofit is so important. Because retrofit is, you're delivering lower energy bills for our residents, particularly at a time where, you know, we know, for example, people need every pound they can get when it comes to sort of the impact of our economy and the support they need. But actually... if you think about the skills and the jobs that are going to come for that, particularly for people in those communities, it's huge. And then one final example I give you is, we delivered recently the London Stadium. We funded through the Green Finance Fund the 3,350 solar membranes that went on the roof of the stadium.
I remember seeing that. That was quite a feat.
First stadium to have it. And typically it's difficult to put solar panels on roof of stadiums because of the weight restriction. But we use these like membranes, they're like yoga mats and solar panels. And I was talking to Amoresco, who was installing the, they won the contract from London Stadium to deal with it. And I asked them this question, which is basically, how many of the jobs went to local people or people like in that vicinity? So it could be like Tower Hamlets, Newham, Hackney, or Waltham Forest, which is the Olympic boroughs. And they were like, very little. They were honest about it. And I asked them, so what was the reason? Like, what was the main barriers for it? And they were just like, the skills just don't exist. Not just in that vicinity, but actually for the whole London. And it just made me think, in some ways, and it's not Amoresco's fault, by the way, because we need to do more to make sure that people are upskilled so that we create that market.
We need a coalition of the willing to do that. I mean, it's right that you're posing that challenge. But I guess it's the responsibility of not just public bodies like the GLA, local authorities and government, also the private partners to find out, how do you upskill those people on the ground?
Exactly.
And how can they also benefit from the jobs that are being created and have the skills to...
And we basically, in London Climate Action Week, we set up a London Climate Task Force, Finance Task Force, which is basically thinking about, how do we accelerate the investment around a green economy? But also, if you think about the London Growth Plan and the talent strategy that we're going to have, that's going to be complementing that. It's essentially your point, because I think where public bodies can be helpful is setting the policy framework to almost like set the direction for the private sector. In terms of knowing, because, you know, for example, if we go out with saying 22,000 homes are going to be improving energy efficiency, then almost like everything shifts around it, because people know, okay, we're going to need jobs. So therefore, they will invest more into training. And so I think our responsibility as those in power is being able to have the right policy framework so that actually we can work together with the private sector and our education skills providers to make sure that we're getting the skills that we need. Otherwise, you know, we risk a real, I guess, like, challenge of getting people trained up.
And I think out of the Climate Week and the action that came out of it, what was the main learning, do you think? And actually, for us to close, what was your message to London Climate Week, and what would your message be to those listening who want to be part of the action that Sehol's taking, that you're taking?
Yeah, well, this London Climate Action Week was special because it was the biggest in Europe. It was literally the Glastonbury of Climate Weeks. But I think...
Which you were at Wireless the other day too.
I was at Wireless, yeah.
Honestly, can I join your team? That's like a good... I mean, not least because of the work that you're doing, but you're reaching people where they are.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say to you. So like, what I'm trying to do in my role, and this comes from a bit of my background of like, again, not being involved in this world before, is trying to go where people go to in their day-to-day social, digital lives and think about how we connect with them in their space. So whether that's at like festivals, whether it's like, you know, speaking through podcasts like yourself, lots of different ways which we engage with Londoners. But a key thing that came out of London Climate Action Week, and I think this is where London could really show global leadership at a time where we've got a climate denier in charge of the most powerful country in the world, is that actually cities are going to be at the front line when it comes to dealing with the impacts of climate change. Are the ones who are leading the innovation and the solutions when it comes to climate action. And cities need to have a seat at the table when it comes to COP. And that's what it does. One of the biggest arguments that we made at London Climate Action Week, which is actually speaking to the Brazilian presidency to say, please give cities a role at COP. And, you know, we're very pleased that at London Climate Action Week this year, they're committed to making sure that, you know, C40 cities and other sort of cities have a big role when it comes to COP this year, which is going to be for the first time, and it's really exciting.
Well, indeed, and we were at COP back in 2021, if you remember.
Yeah,
and
it was a
real eye-opener for me, because you described yourself as not a natural environmentalist, and I probably would agree with you on that one. But the work that you're doing and so many other partners across not just London, but across the world, is it's incredible work. And
yeah, and we learn so much. It. You know, we learn so much from other cities. Like, it's not London knows it all best, you know. Like, there's so much amazing innovation happening. Like, Bogota, the work they're doing in Colombia around zero-emission buses. I mean, we got the highest number of zero-emission buses for any city in the Western world. Over 2,000 of our buses are zero-emission with a plan to get 100% by 2030. But we're learning so much from other cities around what they're doing around heat, Copenhagen, around cleaning the rivers. But equally, they learn from us as well. And I think that's the power of, you know, having this network, which is that actually, you know, climate change doesn't know no borders, right? Even like when we're thinking about flooding in London, partly what we're trying to do is get in the boroughs working together, because water doesn't go from Southwark to Lambeth and say, hey, I'm stopping here because there's a borough line here. We need to actually work across boroughs. We need to work with other cities, because ultimately climate change affects the whole world, and we're only going to be able to solve it through that partnership.
And London's a great leader in that. Although we haven't touched so much on government, I wonder, it must be so refreshing for you going from working in Hackney and being at the front line of the defence for your residents, but now having a government that you can, well, the mayor's office can work more constructively with. I wonder, what is that relationship like, and what steps have you seen from national government that you're quite looking forward to implementing?
I mean, look, there's been a huge step change since we've had a new government. You know, you take, for example, the investment in Transport for London and the certainty that gives to our transport network, and also the environmental measures that we were able to bring in place. If you think about, you know, I spoke about retrofit and warmer homes London, what we've done in London. So just to give, again, a bit of background to this, but what used to happen in London before was really bizarre, which is you had this system where every council had to apply for money for retrofit from government. Yeah. The problem with that is twofold. One is that it's a competition war between
like a bidding war.
Exactly. The second thing is most councils, for everyone who's listened, will know the last 14 years have been, their back offices have been completely stripped out. A lot of them are dealing with sort of the, you know, the repairs, don't have the capacity to even think about retrofit. So there are some councils that don't even apply for the funding. So what we done is we set up Warmer Homes London, working with government, to basically lead a consortium bid. And actually government's investment in London, £232 million, 22,000 homes that would be improving the energy efficiency. That's a step change because of the, you know, government that we have who's put this focus on retrofit. And, you know, a long time we want to work around the integrated settlement around retrofit. But the work we're doing around rivers, I mean, you see, you know, Steve Reed's leadership when it comes to, for example, holding water companies to account, particularly with the announcement around, you know, the regulator as well. And so there is a massive step change in terms of, like, you know, alignment on policy. You know, for the first time, we've got a government who is serious about taking climate action. A mayor of London has obviously put this at the heart of his mayoralty, and also formidable councils. I think across three different layers of government, we can have a huge impact over the next 3 years.
Absolutely. And if it all goes well, I'd be interested to know, especially from you thinking about your legacy. You're just a year in, but I wish you all the best as you continue on in your role. What does a better London look like in 2030? And can you picture, as we close today's interview, what would it look like for someone stepping out of their front door into a London that you and the mayor are looking to create?
So firstly, I think better air quality. You wouldn't drink dirty water. So how we have ever normalized dirty air is beyond me. So having much more better air quality for the sake of our children, more access to green space, particularly for Londoners who don't have access to a garden, and better public spaces as well, green spaces. You know, more public spaces where Londoners can actually spend their time making sure that we're more resilient to the impacts of climate change through, you know, the suds, through more street trees, making sure that, for example, our buildings are much more energy efficient, and actually being more innovative around how we install solar panels, how we support our schools, how do we support cultural centres, our iconic venues. So for me, there's so much work to do. And actually, as I'm talking about it, I'm thinking of so many things to say, because it's like, you know, there's so much we need to be doing. And that's what that, when you talk about a decade of delivery, that's what it's about. It's about actually getting on with the job. There's, we know the solutions to this. We just got to crack on and deliver it.
And indeed, and on that note, Mete, thank you so much for your time, and thanks a lot to all our listeners for taking the time to listen to this episode of Better Places podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation, make sure that you subscribe, share it with anyone who's listened, who's interested even in how we shape the cities that work for people and the planet. And you can find out more about Mete's work either online or at london.gov.uk, and you can follow the podcast for more stories from the people who are helping to build a fairer, greener London and better places for us all. So until next time,
thank you so much.
Thank you.